it just drives me crazy that we have a food system that makes no common sense.
What kind of sense does it make when semis carrying fresh strawberries grown in New York State head west to grace San Francisco fruit salads, while semis carrying California strawberries pass them in mid-continent, heading east to garnish New York desserts?
Trade is a good thing, but what if we traded more between local communities instead of through the big global market?
What a concept. Eat what grows near your dinner plate rather than what's grown across the continent or halfway around the world. Support your local farmer and your local economy, and in the process, lower your carbon contribution to global warming.
When we walked into the supermarket when we first started out, we immediately realized, okay, 9 of these 10 aisles are full of boxes that don't say where any of the ingredients are from.
Today on A World of Possibilities, grow local, eat local, feeding our hunger for connection.
Really, my local food activism came through this desire to put food back into the context of relationships.
The budding grow local, buy local, eat local movement even translates into a traditionally one-crop region like the tobacco country of the southeastern United States, where some farmers, pressured by changing crop allotments, have switched from cigarettes to squash and tomatoes.
It's been terrific to be able to begin to replace that and see that farmers can actually make substantially more raising organic vegetables and doing something they're really proud of because it's a very healthy thing rather than detrimental.
I'm Mark Sommer. Join us for a trip down back roads to far places, the locales where local food is eaten near where it's grown. Welcome to A World of Possibilities. In the gourmet ghettos of the San Francisco Bay Area, it's tough to attend a dinner party these days without first learning the provenance of pasture-raised poultry. Following the ancient rhythm of the seasons, Chef Jessica Prentice holds court before a dedicated diners with ladle in hand, presenting a cornucopia of gastronomic delicacies, all grown or harvested within a 100-mile radius of where they dine. The self-described culinary adventurer and passionate food activist began her journey as a teenager struggling to gain control of her appetite and create a healthy relationship with food. Frustrated with the vast distances food travels before reaching her dinner plate, Jessica co-founded Locavores, a merging of the words local and omnivores that conveys a double passion for eating lots of everything grown at close range. The idea has caught on like kudzu. Today, Jessica is cooking it up at the Three Stone Hearth, a worker-owned cooperative, serving up local foods she and others refer to by the somewhat unappetizing term nutritionally dense. To recount her quest for connection with what grows in her own region, Jessica Prentice joins us now from her home in Berkeley.
I went through a process of really sort of looking inside myself and exploring my creativity, and this food thing kept coming up over and over and over again, and you know, I'd always been interested in it, I'd always loved to cook, and it was at that point that I decided I was going to go to cooking school. And so it sort of started with that. I went to cooking school, but you know, I still hadn't sort of had the big epiphany. It was really in cooking school that I really started to think about relationship, food and relationship, and started to get very frustrated by the anonymity of our food system and the lack of connection that we have to the earth through our food, the lack of connection that we have to other people through our food, to the people who grow our food, to understanding how foods are made and where they come from. All of those links really seem to be broken. And I started to feel that the reason that I'd had such a troubled relationship to food as a teenager really had to do with the fact that I wanted and I knew that food should be this thing that really connected us, you know, spiritually to everybody else and everything else, and that it didn't. And really, my local food activism came through this desire to put food back into the context of relationship.
So at what point did you decide that local was paramount for you and then move towards founding Locavores?
The more that I, you know, shopped locally and ate local foods from the farmer's market, and the more I learned about agriculture, and the more it became just compelling, just the more compelling it is. It's just one of those things where it feeds you on so many levels that it becomes really hard to, you know, go to a grocery store and buy a bunch of scallions after seeing piles of scallions and, you know, at the farmer's market with the person standing behind them who actually picked them. And I also started really being educated on, you know, all of the big picture environmental issues, the petroleum one being a major one, really understanding that our food system as it is now is only possible with a steady supply of cheap petroleum. I started to see our current food system really as this very, very fragile kind of house of cards, and this cheap petroleum card being right at the bottom, and started to really think about, once you pull that card out, how are we going to survive? How are we going to feed ourselves? And it just drives me crazy that we have a food system that makes no common sense.
I'm intrigued by the subtitle of your book. The book is called Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. That hunger is, this goes back to your sense of spirituality. In fact, it seems to make the connection between food and spirituality.
And that's because that's really what the book is about, is I really believe I'm not the only person to have this hunger for connection. And food can play a very vital role in feeding that hunger. I mean, not just feeding our bodies, but feeding that spiritual hunger, that hunger for connection to other people, that hunger for connection to the earth, to plants, and to animals. And I think part of why people are so distraught, particularly around factory farming and the factory farming of animals, is there's a kinship that we have with these animals, and they're being abused, and we feel that abuse. It hurts us. And I think, you know, our view of reality in the United States is sort of hyper-materialist, but I'm trying with this book to kind of peel that back and look at life from sort of a different angle that I think, you know, all traditional cultures have, and we've kind of lost a little bit of sense of here.
You've been holding occasional full moon feasts. Tell us about what those are like.
Yeah, well, since the business started, they've been more than occasional. They're pretty much monthly. So on the Saturday closest to the full moon, we have a big feast, and we have about 100 people every month, and we invite a speaker. Usually it's a farmer, rancher. Sometimes it's an author, an importer. I'm not against imported ingredients, but again, I want those to be the things that we can't grow here, and the more relationship and knowledge that we have about how those things are grown and where and the context, I think the better. So we do a family-style dinner, and then we have the speaker, and usually the way it works is I interview them, you know, about a 20-minute live interview and in front of people, and then people and I take questions from the audience, and it's a lot of fun.
Now, as I understand it, this is it's somewhat upscale. I mean, you're using very expensive ingredients, and you end up having to charge $30 or $40 a person. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a $40 per person donation.
I see.
You know, I don't think of it as upscale. The atmosphere is very relaxed. I've been to a lot of sort of sustainability dinners that feel very chichi, and this one doesn't. It's pretty down to earth. The issue really is that there are true costs involved in the food. If we serve chicken, for example, we're serving pastured chicken. Pastured chicken is very, very expensive and challenging to produce. You can't get it year-round. When I'm able to get it, it's wholesaled to me for $4.50 a pound. So on top of that, you know, we've got our rent, 5 worker owners that need to earn a salary. $40 a person is just sort of the minimum that it takes to pay the bills. And the only thing is that people aren't used to paying the true cost of food.
There is a challenge in that. It's like local is extraordinarily important, organic is extraordinarily important, and affordability somehow, which really means access for people, seems to be important. It hasn't really been, in all of these movements, it hasn't been fully addressed yet.
You know, I do think that all of these movements have really been struggling with this and trying to address it. The problem is that our food in this country is extremely cheap. And the amount that we spend as a portion of income on food is at an all-time low and is low compared to almost every other country as well. You know, I really feel like food is one of the few things that really actually matters. It's one of the few things that really can have a marked effect on our health. We pay a huge amount in health insurance, which doesn't insure our health. We haven't said that food is so fundamental that it's precious, it's priceless. And so I really don't think that we need to be attacking this problem from the end of how do we make, you know, local, organic, sustainable foods cheaper. It really has to be a societal discussion about what our priorities are. And I actually don't spend too much time sort of worrying about how are we going to convince people to eat locally, yada, yada, yada. I'm much more interested in the question of once we only have to eat locally because we don't really have this cheap alternative, are we going to be able to do it? And what are we going to have the infrastructures in place to be able to survive without this globalized system? Because I really think it's crumbling. I'm much more interested in how can we live well in the meantime and how can we prepare ourselves as best as possible for that eventuality, so that when that card at the bottom of the house of cards gets pulled out, there's something else in place that keeps the structure up.
Chef and Locavores co-founder Jessica Prentice. Find out more and join the Eat Local Challenge at locavores.com, locavores.com. We're off now to Middle America, a world away from the Bay Area birthplace of the locavores movement, in the rolling hills and pasture lands of southeastern Kansas. Here, where a local agrarian heritage struggles to maintain a vanishing niche among industrial parks and corporate agribusiness, we find Diana Endicott of Rainbow Farm in Bronson, Kansas. After years of running a landscape business in Dallas, Diana and her husband moved back to their childhood home to realize their dream of working a small family farm. Now occupying 400 acres, their certified organic ranch includes beef cattle, vegetables, grain, and hay. But it all started with a tomato. Years before most Americans even thought of eating local, this husband and wife team boldly marched into their local supermarket, tomatoes in hand, and persuaded a grocery chain to start carrying their early girls. Rainbow Farm is now part of a cooperative they co-founded called Good Natured Family Farms. To describe her family's return to its roots and their community's return to locally produced food, Diana joins us now from her farmstead in Bronson, Kansas. What was it like to go to them the first time? There you just have a few tomatoes and you're going to a great big supermarket chain.
That's where ignorance comes in real handy.
In other words, you didn't really know.
No, my background was not in marketing, and so we just took one box of tomatoes and took it into the store to the produce manager and said, Jack Otterman was his name, as a matter of fact, and said, we have these tomatoes, and we'd like to see if you'd be interested in buying them. And he took one bite, and he said, bring us what all you have.
That must have been a great moment for you.
Yeah, it was really, not knowing the corporate structure or being exposed to the corporate structure was probably a good thing.
So tomatoes, you got into tomatoes in a big way. And how did you happen to get into meat as well?
Well, during that same time, we had the Canadian tomatoes coming into Kansas City. And then we had the cogeneration plants that were being built, and the market in Kansas City became flooded with greenhouse tomatoes. So therefore, the price plummeted. We scaled back on the numbers that we were producing. And at that same time, we had a cow-calf herd that we'd been building over the years. The beef market was down. So I went to Ball's Foods, or Hen House Markets, and met with their meat director and asked them if they would be interested in trying a new locally grown beef. And they said yes, so we started with one head of beef, and they were just looking for a new beef program at the same time. So we started with one head, and we kind of learned together because no one had done this for years. I mean, they have not taken farm-raised beef directly to the supermarket.
And from the beginning, did you have in mind all-natural beef and going for the sort of premium market?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's what we did in the landscaping business in Dallas. We were really looking at the premium market.
How large a segment would you say that is of the marketplace in that region around Kansas City?
Well, I think what's really surprising is that as we've grown, part of what we are about now is we are really looking for now bringing the products to the average consumers. And I think even though we are priced a little bit higher than the lowest type price meat, we still are not an exclusive type product any longer.
When did that change, and how were you able to make it so that it could be more affordable for average consumers and still make enough to make it worthwhile for you to raise the beef?
When we first started, we were partnering with small locker plants, and then the one that we had built the longest-term relationship with burnt to the ground, and we purchased a small processing plant locally here. And so that, again, is you're starting off, instead of building a new facility, you're starting off with something that is very affordable, very small, and therefore you have your low overhead. Then I think over the years, we've seen beef prices go up, and as beef prices go up, dairy prices go up, then your margins are less and less. So therefore, your products become more affordable.
At some point, you decided to launch with others a Good Natured Farms beef cooperative. Is that right?
As we started growing the beef program, the demand for the beef increased, and we started networking with other farmers that we knew were raising beef on their farm, and then they formed the All Natural Beef Co-op. That is what they have, I think, 27 members now, and they provide the beef, and then all of our products are under a brand called Good Natured Family Farms. which is an alliance, and we have now have about 75 family farms in that alliance.
And you ship the beef around the whole region or even beyond?
No, we specifically, right now, we can just supply the hen house markets. They have exclusivity with that product because that right now that's all we can supply.
Does hen house find that they sell well?
The beef industry and the supermarkets had a very, over the last couple of years, have been, you know, kind of stagnant. And ours has been the bright spot, I guess, in the scenario, and that we've actually seen some tremendous growth increase.
Why do you think that is? Is it increased consumer awareness of the hazards of commercially raised beef?
I think it is just more of people wanting to connect. I mean, we've had some food safety issues, and I definitely think that that's brought a large consumer awareness of where our food is grown. However, I think in the mass market, I mean, if you're selling to a health food store like Whole Foods or Wild Oats or something like that, you may have a different demographic of people. But when you're selling to the conventional market and competing against, I don't want to say competing, but you're in the market with conventional beef products, we've always looked at it that we are an additional sale. We're not a replacement sale. We don't try to make negativity about how other farmers or other businesses have chosen to raise their beef or raise their product or sell their product. What we try to do is we just really try to focus on the positive things about what we're doing. And I think people buy our product, number one, because of taste. Even if it was from the family farm and it had all these great attributes, if it didn't taste good and or better than the other products, they wouldn't be buying it.
But you also said connection. What did you mean by that?
In this area, in the Kansas City area, at one time, the farming areas were really a lot closer to the city, and a lot of the people that live there now have some connection to farming. They either farmed before, retired and moved there. They've had an uncle or an aunt that farmed, and they have maybe a romance of what they remember about farming. And I think that this provides, these locally grown foods provide that emotional connection, and I think that's what they're trying to connect to. You know, you have less than 2% of the population farming now. You know, most of it is privatized farms. So people really, you know, it's very difficult to say, well, I'm going to go out today and I'm going to go spend the day at the farm. We don't have ready access to private land.
This takes a lot of effort. I would imagine that upscale landscaping in Dallas, for all the stress, was an easier way to make a living than doing this. Did you ever along the way find yourself scratching your head and said, why did I take something that's so much harder?
Well, I do that on a regular basis now.
I thought you were going to say, no, I never think that way.
No, not at all. I think that we really look at what is our passion. And I guess my passion has always been to do what people say cannot be done. And so when we started, again, not knowing has been a huge advantage, I believe. And then as you go down the road, each challenge is the next one to overcome. And then whenever you get to scratching your head and you say, well, why am I doing this? It always seems to be that something comes along and it's enough to make you feel good.
Diana Endicott. In a moment, the foodies of Northern Michigan.
Bought myself a farm way out in the country. Took to growing lettuce, milk, and cows, and honey. Bought myself a farm way out in the country.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
Yes, it's good living on the farm. Also good living on the farm.
The Midwest is sometimes viewed by provincial coast dwellers as mere flyover, not much worth stopping to see. And for the most part, locals like keeping the secret that it's actually a great place to live in. In half-wild northern Michigan, a localist food culture is sprouting from the rock-strewn soil. When some said there was no future in the region for small farmers, Patty Cantrell begged to differ. Where some saw extinction, she saw opportunity. As entrepreneurial agricultural director for the Michigan Land Use Institute, She noticed savvy small business owners thriving by being innovative and staying attuned with what their customers really wanted. Fresher, more natural ingredients, and a relationship with the farmers and land on which their food is grown. In 2002, the Institute began a project to point struggling farmers towards renewed prosperity by expanding local food choices for Michiganders and gaining environmental protection for threatened farmland in the process. It's in an industrial agricultural system where prices and decisions are determined thousands of miles from where the food is grown, where local farmers get plowed under. But the local food movement makes it easier for farmers to withstand the pressures of the global marketplace. From the studios of Interlaken Public Radio in Interlaken, Michigan, Patty Cantrell joins us to share the story of one local dairy that got it right.
You know, one good example here is a farm, and I know this has happened elsewhere around the country, that had a small herd of cows, 40 cows, and they know them all by name. And in the big bulk market, they were getting hardly any money for their milk and were pouring their milk into the same vat as a bunch of farms that didn't produce the same quality that they did. So they said, how could we market this in a different way? They had to develop their own bottling plant, a very small bottling plant. And that's where we need to help farms more, because a lot of the equipment that they needed at a smaller scale wasn't available. But they found some, and now their business is so successful, they sell glass-bottled milk that is not homogenized. That's partly what they do. The customer wants that. Now their kids are coming back to live on the farm because there's so much opportunity, and other farms are getting into the same market.
Why is it important to you and to those you work with to eat local and to supply locally?
Up here, you know, we look outside and we still have open countryside and clean water, and people are beginning to connect that farm with those things that they want around them. That also translates to when people have businesses in town, they have kids in school, they're involved in their community. And we have found on a variety of levels that we've been working on that that's one of the biggest drivers, is people building those kind of relationships in their community. And that's one of the big ones with local food.
As I understand it, your organization also supplies local food to hospitals and schools. Tell us, first of all, about the hospitals.
What they're doing is at least once a week in the summer, they are featuring a local farmer and that farmer's product. So they started in May and June with asparagus here, and the cafeteria brought the farmer in, and people came down to buy that food, but also boxes of asparagus from that farmer in line. So the employee has a card and they can go through, buy lunch and buy asparagus. And the farmer, all the farmers that participate go through pounds and pounds and flats of their product, because people find it convenient to buy from them right there. And the purpose with this is just to kind of introduce people to a lot of foods they may not eat, to the farmer, and also get to know what it's like to buy local food. And I know that the hospital is interested in how they might get it into the patient's food eventually, or follow some interesting models around the country where they have farmers markets at hospitals.
Oh, that's interesting. I never heard of that.
Yeah. The big leader in that is the Kaiser Permanente Health System, and they started with one of these at a hospital in California, and now they have about 32 or 35 in five states at different hospitals.
Do you think that there are other aspects of having a farmer's market in a hospital environment that could be healing in ways we can't even see, that have not so much to do with the nutrients in the food, but the, dare I use a California word, vibe of having the farmer's market in that environment?
I think the whole movement is really around people having a relationship with each other. And so when you put a farmer's market into a hospital scene like that, you do get more color, you get people talking to each other, you get, you know, oohs and ahs over eggplant and carrots, and people, there's just a joyous feeling that can come out of that. And I do believe that's healing. You know, we've seen that in the work we've done with schools. Our Taste the Local Difference program has been working with three different districts, and about 41 school sites have all started experimenting and serving some local foods. And the children are really responding to the fact that it's something different. There's a farmer that produces it, and it comes from their area. And again, it's a heart connection to the food, not just a plate of carrots in front of them.
So local is important, but is it such an imperative that you really need to say, look, I'm not going to buy this particular product because it's not within my 100-mile radius?
That's not where I am. I'm more into building the local structures needed to make those choices available to you. Trade is a good thing, but what if we traded more between local communities as instead of through the big global market, where it's very faceless and there's no accountability to a community? There's something about a face and accountability in your place that is what's driving my interest in local food and local community. And trade and regions and stuff working together, I think, fits into that. And, you know, the fair trade movement around where the profits go back to those farmers is, I think, part of the same movement, the same interest that people have, because there's buying Kenyan coffee or there's buying the coffee where you know the farmer in the community is benefiting from it. And the same forces that cause those problems there are causing problems in American small communities.
So there's a different kind of global market emerging. It's not that it isn't a global market. It's that it's global local.
Yeah, I like to call it a world of markets.
Oh, I like
instead
that.
Instead of one big global market and you're just flotsam in it, maybe a world of markets that have identities that can relate in different ways and where you have some bearing in your community and relationship to the others. That, to me, is what international economics is all about.
Is it important that localism not become isolationism?
I believe that that's a danger. You know, every time a good idea or a movement like this happens, you can get religious or militaristic about it. And so I would agree. It's not about isolationism. It's about connection.
Yes. It actually seems that it's precisely the opposite of isolationism. And it's less about homogenization. You talked about how people don't want homogenized milk anymore. Maybe we don't want homogenized cultures or homogenized agriculture. Maybe what we want is much more of a mosaic.
Yeah, and I that's what's so exciting to me, because people who buy food, eaters, are becoming less tolerant of the bland stuff that's being placed in them. People are understanding that milk with cream on top can be exquisite, and part of the local food movement or the good food movement is just that discovery and the celebration of that. And it can be produced from a farm next door. And it's not like we all have to know each other one-on-one, but that spirit, that connection, it travels through the economy and community in a lot of unknown ways.
I'm also thinking you said earlier that particular places become known for their very special climates, for example, like the Napa Valley for wine in California or Bordeaux in France.
Mm-hmm. And I think what happens, and that is happening, is that then we defined that there's so much to choose from. And that doesn't mean that one group wins out over another on a melon. It's more just the huge diversity of tastes and flavors that we can enjoy.
That means actually that the customer consumer can be the driving force in re-diversifying agriculture. It's the consumer who's saying, no, give me more variety, not less.
Right. The driving force being, I'm ready to try something else. I think the consumer is driving that. I think also the consumer is beyond just buying food. They're more of a citizen of their community, and all those other factors are coming into play. So I agree with that, but I guess I would broaden the definition of who we're talking about, because the eater, the consumer, is also the voter, the person who's dealing with some water pollution somewhere, and all those things are coming back together into where the food comes from and how it's being produced, and that person has a lot of different ways to influence the system.
Patty Cantrell, Entrepreneurial Agricultural Director for the Michigan Land Use Institute. I'm Mark Summer. And this is a world of possibilities distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.